The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Where are you, Richard?
I'm sitting outside a cafe called Daniele's in Bassano del Grappa in Veneto in Italy. A place that Daniel knows very well, don't you, Daniel?
I do pretty well. And you clearly are fitting in. You're getting nicely settled there. Your pronunciation has improved in the last three or four days. I noticed that you put the emphasis on the right syllable in Veneto there.
Working on it, Daniel. Working on it. I've been here for 6 days, so if I don't know it now, I'll never know it. We spent a night here at the Giro a couple of years ago, didn't we? I think at the end of the 2018
we did,
Giro.
Rich, yeah.
Or 19, perhaps. Yeah, 19 it was.
I'm tempted to ask you to pop into the little shop on the famous bridge there, the famous wooden bridge, the Ponte degli Alpini, and there's a shop there. Well, there's the distillery, I think, the distillery, or maybe just a shop that sells Nardini Grappa, but they also do a Grappa toothpaste that I bought last
time.
That's
right.
But unfortunately, it was terrible. it was absolutely wrong.
So why do you want more?
Don't bother. No, I mean, it was a nice sort of party trick to produce that.
Well, I've had a couple of grappas while I've been here, and I just had a cappuccino at 10:48 a.m. just before the cutoff. But I've been here for 6 days, enjoying a new week of cycling that's been put together by Filippo Pozzato. Ride the Dreamland, it's called. It's the branding for three races, including a professional gravel race and a Gran Fondo. And it's been a lot of fun. I go home tonight. Weather, absolutely perfect. I mean, it's very late in the year, obviously, for racing. But the weather's been perfect. It's been pretty lucky with that. Glorious sunshine, 17, 18 degrees every day. And a pretty successful first effort, I think. We'll hear from Filippo Pozzato and others associated with the races and this week a little bit later on. But before all that, do you have a news roundup for us, Lionel?
I do. Lots going on. So chip in wherever you want to, chaps. But let's start with those Italian races, shall we? The end of season events across the north of Italy, starting with the Coppa Agostoni, won by Alexei Lutsenko of the Astana team. And, well, that foreshadowed a couple of other fine results for Astana, really, because Samuele Battistella won the Veneto Classic you were talking about, Richard. And then Lutsenko won the Serenissima gravel race, so the so-called first professional gravel race. But, I mean, this is an area of debate here, isn't it? Because what would Strada Bianca be? That's not gravel, I guess. That's just white, dusty roads. So we're dividing up a niche into sub-niches. There was also the Giro del Veneto, which was won by Zandro Muris. And, it's the kind of end of season Italian races, which when I was watching cycling in the sort of 80s and 90s, these were the races that sort of led up to the World Championships, weren't they? And then they all really struggled for a few years. And there does seem to be quite a revival of these races, but we'll talk about that in this episode. There was also the British National Championships for the first time since 2019, postponed, of course, last year, or cancelled rather, because of the coronavirus pandemic. And Ben Swift defended the title he won in 2019. He out-muscled Fred Wright on the final climb, the famous climb. Anyone who knows the Lincoln Grand Prix of Michael Gate, cobbled hill that wouldn't look out of place in Belgium, really. Ben Swift winning the title. And that's three Swift wins in a row, because his cousin Connor won in 2018. Ethan Hayter, who was third, had earlier in the week won the time trial, and his younger brother Leo won the under-23 time trial. The women's road race was won by Pfeiffer Georgie, and the women's time trial was won by Anna Henderson. One little story from the men's time trial: Alex Dowsett, who is preparing for his world hour record attempt in a few weeks' time, was he abandoned the time trial. He's a six-time champion, of course, but he described his pre-race preparation as aggressive nitrate loading, drinking lots of beetroot shots, and it caused him some discomfort, and apparently he was throwing up on the bike. And this was a test ahead of the hour record attempt in Mexico, so I guess he'll be steering clear of the beetroot before he attempts his hour record. He's trying to win back the record. He held it in 2015 for just over a month before Bradley Wiggins broke it, and then the current holder Victor Campenaerts set the record of 55.089 kilometres, and Dowsett is going to Mexico to ride at altitude to try and get his record back. But there are already reports that Filippo Ganna is preparing for an attempt on the hour record as well, and has ridden a half-hour test at 57.5 kilometres an hour. So the hour record is hotting up again. Sticking with a bit of time trialling, the final time trial event of the season, the Chrono des Herbiers in the Vendée region of Western France, was won by Stephen Kung of Groupama FDJ, and the women's race was won by Marlon Roussa in her final race before she joins SD Works. The Cyclocross World Cup, which got underway a couple of weeks ago, the US swing is now over, and the third round was a repeat of the first round in a way. The races in Iowa were won by Ellie Isabit and Marianne Vos, and now the cyclocross goes back to Belgium with a round in Zonhoven this weekend. And it's Groundhog Day for the Quebecer Next Hash team. Doug Ryder is again searching for a sponsor, isn't he? An email came out this week confirming that the team has been unable to put together its application for a 2022 World Tour license. There have been reports that the team's been struggling to pay its riders since August. Since the summer, there have been some questions about the stability of NextHash, the co-sponsor, which is a cryptocurrency company. I must admit, cryptocurrency is a bit of a mystery to me, but the team is basically appealing for backers to help them carry on, and they were in very much this position last year, so they were successful in managing to keep the team on the road last year, but being in the same boat again this year, well, it's going to be just as difficult to pull off. I don't know whether you guys have got any info on how things are looking for Quebecer.
Well, I saw that a clarification on NextHash, that they were never going to become, although they signed up apparently for 4.5 years, they weren't going to become the title sponsor beyond this year. So they replaced ASOS for the rest of this year. But the team were always, as Victor Campenaerts said at the Giro, always looking for a new title sponsor for next year and beyond. So in that sense, things haven't changed. I guess the reports of non-payments to riders is alarming. And it is late in the year, isn't it? Although it was about the same time last year that, because of course the Giro was still going on at this time last year, wasn't it? And the team was saved even later than this. And so I guess there's still hope, but it does look, it could be a forlorn hope. And there could be one fewer team in the World Tour next year. They've missed the application date, haven't they, for a World Tour license for next year. So yeah, big questions.
I mean, I think some hopes were raised by the news about a week ago that Premier Tech, who are currently a co-sponsor of Astana, had pulled out of talks with Bike Exchange, Jerry Ryan and his organisation. And they, well, it's well known that they're sort of in the market for another team, a co-sponsorship. And it seemed, well, Quebecer seemed like an obvious option. They'd already been linked, those two, Quebecer and Premier Tech. But last week, we also had the news that Jakob Fuglsang had signed an extraordinary three-year contract. I think he's 36, isn't he, Fuglsang? Three-year contract with Israel Startup Nation. Ugo Uhl, the Canadian rider, has also gone to Israel Startup Nation. And one deduction that you could make from that is that Premier Tech are destined to become co-sponsors of Israel Startup Nation. I believe that may well happen, although Premier Tech also want quite a lot of input control in terms of how the team, whichever team they join, is run. And I think they also want equity. They want to be part owners of the team that they go to.
And lastly, everyone will remember the fan who held up the sign that said Ale Opi Omi, a sign for her grandparents during the opening stage of the Tour de France when she was facing away from the oncoming peloton and caused a crash. Tony Martin was first down and around 50 other riders went down. Several riders had to quit the race and Marc Soler broke both his arms in that crash. It was a really serious incident. Created a lot of anger at the time. The person who held up the sign has been in court in Brest in Brittany last week facing criminal charges for causing that crash. And if found If the case is upheld, she faces a four-month suspended prison sentence. The verdict is expected in December. And meanwhile, the CPA, the Association of Professional Cyclists, have also filed a civil suit for a symbolic compensation claim of €1. And Richard, I know you you have some thoughts on this.
Well, thanks, Lionel. No, I mean, I know some of our listeners feel that it's a proportionate punishment, that, you know, the possibility of a prison sentence, even suspended prison sentence, is a fitting punishment for her crime. But I don't. I mean, I don't think it's appropriate. And I also think it sets a bad precedent. I mean, where do we draw the line if people are going to be blamed for causing crashes? She clearly was to blame, but there's a difference between that incident, I think, and the incident at the women's tour recently where somebody threw a parking cone into the path of the riders to try and cause a crash. You know, in her case, it was an accident. And as it was pointed out to me, intent is not everything. No, it's not. But I feel that she is being very, very harshly treated and made an example of, when the responsibility for safety lies also with the organisers. And the Tour de France, other big races happen on the open road. I'm not sure that enough is done to educate people at the side of the road, especially when there are as many as there were at the Tour de France last year, about how to behave when the riders come through, because I think it catches a lot of people by surprise, the speed at which they come and the fact that they can pack the road on both sides. And I don't think anything is done really to educate people about how they should behave.
Well, when you think about the size of the publicity caravan and the racket it makes for, well, how long does it take to go through? 40 minutes or so. And, you know, people are bombarded with packets of Haribo sweets and what else, Lionel? They get key rings,
Skoda caps,
washing powder in sachets.
There is ample opportunity there. And I think, you guys correct me if I'm mistaken, but possibly after the incident this year, there was more of an effort made. There were messages over some kind of loudspeaker on the publicity caravan or before the publicity caravan to warn people that they needed to stay back. But that's all that needs to happen, really, to put that message across very, very forcefully and literally spell out the exact things that people must not do.
There are adverts on French TV in between the Tour de France coverage warning spectators about their conduct, but it tends to focus on people who run alongside the riders in the mountains rather than just generally standing back and keeping off the road. I'm kind of with you, Richard. I think, you know, it was a terrible accident. She certainly didn't intend to cause a crash. And there is a line between accidental behaviour that deserves some kind of sanction, some kind of punishment, and accidental behaviour, which, you know, was clearly, she was never intending to cause an accident. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that that she could have, you know, intended to do at all. The criminal charges does seem like an overflex to me, but then you say making an example, but perhaps this is something that needs to happen in order to just warn people that there will be serious consequences if you step into
I wouldn't object. I wouldn't object to her being made an example of if you know it'd been an example of you know, as you mentioned, running alongside the riders. There are lots of cases and incidents, and they've been increasing a lot over the last decade, of people entering the field of play, which is what it is, and getting in the rider's way. And any one of those could have caused a bad crash. Generally, they're going uphill. And when they're going uphill, the consequences aren't necessarily as severe. But, you know, when you watch old footage of the Tour de France, the crowds are incredibly well behaved by comparison. And the desire that a lot of people have to get on the TV themselves or to film what's going on and have it in their phone as opposed to watching it themselves with their own eyes, that's made the sport more dangerous, definitely.
Yeah, the sort of inherent irony of this, if you can call it that, is that, as you say, Rich, this behaviour is created by or sort of promoted, fostered by a culture, the sort of selfie culture, people wanting to video themselves. I know this was on network TV. She was actually sort of turning to the main network TV camera, not to a phone, but still, it's kind of the fruit of that sort of behaviour. But I also don't think that she would have been, she probably wouldn't have been, well, there wouldn't have been such a vociferous reaction and such pressure on whether it was the police or someone to do something, and she probably wouldn't have been tracked down if it hadn't been for social media.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thanks very much indeed to our title sponsor, Super Sapiens. Very grateful indeed to them. And to hear a bit more about Super Sapiens, let's hear from the head of sports nutrition at Jumbo-Visma, Asger Jukendrup.
First of all, it starts with fueling before. This is where I think a lot of riders make mistakes. But by doing the measurements and just by practicing your breakfast before training on many occasions, doing these measurements, you can sort of dial in your glucose responses, and that can help you to get to your perfect breakfast before a sportif. So that'd be one thing that is relatively easy to figure out with once you have a sensor. The second thing you can do, of course, is just do your measurements during the training and make sure that your glucose doesn't drop. If it doesn't drop, then you probably do your fueling fairly well. So I think there are two really simple things that anyone can do, and anyone can do immediately once they have the sensors.
Well, thanks once again to Super Sapiens for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Now, I am in Veneto. I'm in Bassano del Grappa at the moment, in a beautiful square here, sipping a cappuccino. But I've been at the races organised by Filippo Pozzato this last week. I also rode the Gran Fondo on Saturday. I'm sure we'll get to that. But there were familiar faces at the Veneto Classic yesterday. Our old friend Ciro Scognamiglio from Gazzetta dello Sport, and the organiser himself, Filippo Pozzato. Let's hear from both of them. Ciro first, and then Pozzato.
No people, no party, no Ciro, no Giro, no Ciro, no Veneto Classic. It's a new race, Ciro. Your old friend, Filippo Pozzato, is the organizer. What have you made of his first efforts? He organized national championships last year, but this week has his fingerprints all over. What have you made of it?
Well, dear Richard and dear listeners, you can really understand my link with Filippo Pozzato, my friendship for him, because instead of doing other things, I'm here. So you can easily understand how big is my friendship for him. But I must confess that I have the impression I came here for the Giro del Veneto, then today from Veneto Classic on Sunday. I mean, I think it's an interesting new format for races to close the season. I think we can talk about a success.
He wants this week to be a bit earlier in the season, doesn't he? But does it actually work as a sort of add-on after Lombardy? You know, there's nothing else on. There are obviously riders who still want to race. People still want to watch racing. Has it worked?
I mean, I think that certainly the best calendar for these races could be or before the Worlds, or for example in the Classics period after San Remo and before the Spring Classics. I mean, more or less, I think could be better, because at the end of the season, certainly there are a lot of riders that want to ride, but in my opinion I completely crazy this kind of rider at this point of the season. Well, we don't need races, we need holidays.
Some of them are at pre-season training camps or bonding camps at the seaside, Ciro.
on Pipo himself, are you surprised that he's become a race organizer? Is this what you imagined he would do in retirement, or has it surprised you?
Filippo is, I know him very well. He's a kind of man, as you say in English, only sky is his limit. So certainly he can do whatever he wants, more or less. And no, I'm really not surprised. And certainly in the future for him, he could grow up also as organizer, not only with only these races, but also with other Italian races. Obviously, I'm not speaking about the Giro or Sanremo or Lombardy, but other races in the calendar, why not?
And finally, Ciro, what are your plans for the winter? What happens to Ciro in the winter?
Richard, in my head, there isn't the winter so far because I have another important appointment, the Track Worlds in Roubaix. So you can imagine, this is my destiny. After being the Shark Shadow, now in the upcoming week, I will be the Filippo Ganna Shadow. So it's a little bit more comfortable because it's really big, but it's not the best destiny for me.
People being very complimentary about the course. You must be very happy with how it went. It was a very exciting race.
Yeah, now I'm happy, but before I have very very big stress, too much more when I stay cycling. But now it's finished, the focus is complete, and I'm very very happy because the guys, the people has fun it for today, as cycling is. Is the sport in this reason, and my heart is very very happy.
And that this race today was the one, I think, that meant the most to you, wasn't it? It was the one that you really wanted to be well received, and the riders were saying it had a mix of everything. You know, the cobbled climb, descending. The climb was a tough course, and we saw a really thrilling race in the end.
Yeah, it's very hard, but I think it's hard because it's in October. It's the final of the season. This is very difficult for the guys because it's very hungry for long season. I think it's very spectacular, the road. It's possible change for the next year because the last free lap on the small climb on Contrasto Arda, I think it's better only one time for the final lap.
I know that, having done it yesterday, it's better no times. if the UCI was to say to you, you could have this week of racing any time in the year, when would you want to have it?
Now I have only three races because it's starting now, but in the future I want to take more races, not only this race, but the objective is this for the future.
In the spring or in September, would that be better, do you think?
Yeah, my dream is a change in September, in the first week of September. But it's very difficult for the calendar, is very, very full every day. I'm working with the UCI for the change the date for the next and the future.
So you're going to have a rest now?
Yeah.
Holiday?
Yeah, yeah. I take 2 or 3 days for a very, very big rest.
Well, chaps, that was Ciro Scognamiglio, and then the organiser of these new events, this new week of racing and riding, Filippo Pozzato. Very ambitious for his events, but the one, as we mentioned there in the interview, the one that was closest to his heart was the Veneto Classic on Sunday, a course that had sort of Pozzato's fingerprints all over it. It had a cobbled climb, some tough roads. We'll hear from Guillaume Martin in a bit as well. He was very active in the race for Cofidis. And these are Pozzato's old training roads, of course, because he's from Sandrigo, which is near to this town where I am, Bassano del Grappa. So that was the race that really he had looked forward to all week. I think the others were maybe to a greater or lesser extent imposed upon him. There was a gravel race as well. We'll come to that. But I thought Sunday's race, the Veneto Classic, was a great race, a very mixed field. Three World Tour teams, but a real range of talents and abilities, I think. but we saw a really interesting race on a course that certainly has a lot of potential to become the classic that he wants it to be.
Yeah, I suppose the first thing to say, Rich, is the Veneto is, well, it's a sort of sleeping giant of Italian cycling in terms of, well, that these three regions, which is sort of the holy trinity, always have been of Italian cycling: Lombardy, Tuscany, and the Veneto. And of course, Lombardy has Milano Sanremo and the Tour of Lombardy, and Tuscany now has Strade Bianche. But these three regions always produce a lot of pros and a lot of, well, they did used to host a lot of races, but the Veneto hasn't had a major race for quite a long time. And well, we were talking about it just before we recorded today, and I think you know, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about some of the factory visits, some of the companies you visited over the weekend. But it has incredible heritage of bike manufacturers, bike accessory manufacturers, particularly saddles, shoes, and so forth. And that has continued, although the industry itself has suffered over the last 20 years because of, you know, a lot of manufacturing has been exported to the Far East, but has continued to produce riders. And yeah, it's overdue, really, that this region has a race worthy of that tradition and that heritage and that history. And the Giro del Veneto, the Veneto Classic on Sunday, it was a great race and a beautiful course as well. It reminded me, in a way, of the World Championship road race, in the sense that it had these two kind of little circuits or two high points in terms of the climbs, the Tisa climb and the La Rosina. La Rosina itself is really famous in Veneto cycling, not because it's featured a lot in the Giro or another race, or that has featured in the Giro, but because the restaurant at the top, La Rosina, every year, I don't know if this tradition has continued, Rich, maybe someone spoke to you about this at the weekend, but all of the Veneto professionals used to congregate there for a sort of a big meal at the end of the season, and there used to be, you know, dozens and dozens of them. There aren't quite that many now, but it was a real sort of sacred place of cycling in the Veneto.
You mentioned the Giro del Veneto, Daniel. I mean, it's a long established event, but hasn't been on the calendar since 2010, and has come back this year to be a part of this week of racing. The 2010 edition was won by Daniel Oss, and Pozzato won it in 2009. So it's his home race at the time. But back then, it was held at the end of August, and it was one of the Italian one-day races that the Italian World Championship selectors used to use as to finalise or hone the World Championship team selection, wasn't it? And so it sort of had a secondary purpose. Whereas having these races in a mid-October slot, just from watching them on the TV, I mean, I'm looking at you, Richard, there. You've got the beautiful blue sky, which matches your shirt and sunglasses, and the yellow-washed brickwork of the building behind you.
All coordinated, Lionel.
And Daniel, you're a keen observer of the light. I mean, the sort of mid-October light in northern Italy is absolutely stunning.
I'm glad you noticed that, Napalm. I'm glad
that. I mean, it's a beautiful thing to, you know, it really transported me away from sort of drizzly, not Watford, watching the sun setting on the race season. But Richard, you mentioned the future of this week of racing and Pozzato's desire to have it a little bit earlier. I guess before the World Championship slot or around.
He would like early September. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it depends on whether, you know, he wants to keep it as this week of racing or just the one event. And I mentioned that his heart was really with the Veneto Classic, the new race, his race, which is clearly the course is designed by him. There was a nod towards the Flemish classics with the cobbled climb Tisa, which was part of the Gran Fondo, as was La Rosina as well. We'll hear a bit from that later on, including the passing of the restaurant at the top, Daniel, because I recorded a bit of slow radio, so we can hear about that. I rode up there with Fabian Cancellara, well, at least for as long as Cancellara could stay with me,
is that your most famous scalp?
No, his desire is definitely to have it in early September, and I heard that he was asking the UCI about, you know, how he could get World Tour status for that race as early as next year. I don't know how realistic that is, but what was impressive, or what has been impressive this last week, has been the desire there clearly has been to have these races in this region. As you say, Daniel, a lot of the cycling industry is based here. The races, the week's events had major support from Campagnolo, Villiers, Elite, Sidi. They're just four of the major cycling brands that are based here. We went and visited all of them, actually, and that's another aspect of the cycling history and tradition here, the industry that's based here. And it makes sense to have not just racing, but this place as a destination for riding as well, which is part of Pozzato's ambition and part of these brands' ambition to put this place on the map as a place to ride your bike as well.
I mean, it really should have a great opportunity, and it's a really interesting time as well in terms of the bike industry, because these are incredible brands with amazing history and heritage. I mean, I lived in Padova near there in the Veneto 20 years ago, and you know, one of the things that I still get sort of nostalgic about when I look at, you know, what happens in the bike industry now is, you know, when you used to go out for a ride in groups, then, you know, everyone would have a different frame made by a different artisanal, frame builder. And obviously the bike industry has completely, it's veered away from that for reasons of practicality and costs. And in the last 10 or 15 years, to greater or lesser extent, the Italian bike manufacturing and accessory manufacturing sort of sector has I think struggled in some cases, not in all cases, but has sort of been racking its brains with how to kind of respond and maintain and consolidate and also sort of move forward. But some of those brands you mentioned, Rich, it seems as though they have kind of emerged, and they're in a position now with things like gravel and also, you know, e-bikes, they are in a position of strength to consolidate also on the appetite for things that are a little bit more artisanal, are a little bit more sort of recherché, and do kind of tap into history, tradition, all those things that we all love about professional cycling.
Well, I mean, I mentioned we went to all these factories. Sidi and Campagnolo were fascinating for the sense you had there of living history. You know, we'll hear more about this in the episode of Explore that I'm making from here, but at the Sidi factory, we met Signor Dino, 86 years old, in the factory every morning at 6:30. He's the man that founded the company over 60 years ago. At Campagnolo, we met Valentino Campagnolo, the son of Tullio Campagnolo, the founder of the company. And there's a real sense that they are true to the origins, the roots of the company. The ethos is still the same, because the people involved are either the original founder or the family of the original founder. And the original founder looms very large over these companies. And yet, you know, in the case of Campagnolo and Sidi, innovation is obviously absolutely crucial for it to survive, because the cycling industry is changing so rapidly. And Campagnolo talking about, you know, huge increase in revenue in the last couple of years, largely thanks to their new gravel group set, apparently. There are kind of new opportunities emerging, it would seem. And that, I think, was partly why there was this first professional gravel race on last Friday, which was won by Alexei Lutsenko. We'd ridden the gravel course the day before. I would describe myself as a gravel skeptic, in that I, first time on a gravel bike, I'm a big fan of my mountain bike. This was, and a few of the riders talked about this afterwards, an unusual gravel race. I guess they're all unusual because they're so new, but there was bits of single track. It was quite technical, quite a lot of loose stones in places. I felt parts of it would have been better on a mountain bike than a gravel bike. So I'm not sure. I mean, you mentioned Strade Bianche earlier, Lionel. The rule in this race was that riders had to ride on gravel bikes, and I think that will be one of the principles of gravel racing. And so there'll be a huge drive from the industry to promote gravel racing and for pros to be on gravel bikes, because it's a new market that's just suddenly appeared in the last couple of years.
What constitutes a gravel bike, strictly speaking? Is it, it's a minimum tire width, isn't it? But what are the features?
It's a good question. The angles of the bike, mainly the wheels and the tires, of course. There's more clearance for bigger, wider tires, but the tires aren't so wide that the ride is really comfortable and I would say safe on some quite technical little trails, which the race did include the other day. So it was strange. We watched, it was a small field, 35 odd riders started, and a lot of them said afterwards that was for the best given the nature of the trails in places. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that a lot of the drive for this is coming from the cycling industry, which makes me also slightly sceptical of it.
Well, this kind of happened with mountain biking, didn't it? At the start of the 90s, there was a big boom in people buying mountain bikes, and so the sporting side of the industry developed a World Championships and a World Cup, which for a while burned very brightly, didn't it? And there was an attempt to make the stars of mountain biking the equivalent of the stars of road cycling. And I think there is a sort of a fracture between participation and, a desire to watch racing. I mean, we've got cyclocross, which is an hour effort. We often talk about how it's the first sort of 10 minutes that sets the tone for the rest of the race. And, there's a danger with gravel racing that it's that kind of spectacle, but just over a longer period of time. Whereas the beauty of Strada Bianca, or when the Grand Tours take the races into more manageable off-road type challenges, is that there's a sort of an understandable, it all kind of links back to the challenge of riding a road bike on, just slightly rougher surfaces. And maybe...
But, yeah.
I don't know, maybe it's just because where I do a lot of my cycling, I the road surfaces around me are not great. And so, I dream of the opportunities to go and ride in Italy or the south of France, yeah, or wherever the surfaces are like black gold. But
don't get me wrong, riding the gravel bike was a lot of fun. The main difference is the speed. You can ride at speed and you can ride in a group on gravel and you get away from the cars, and some of the driving around here left a little bit to be desired when you're out on your bike on your own. But that was a lot of fun, very exhilarating. I enjoyed riding on the gravel, but I just wonder if professional gravel racing does take off. And I think, there are rumours of teams and a lot of riders switching to gravel. Could we see in one of the Grand Tours in the future a proper gravel stage? It's being kind of tested at the Tour de France Femmes next year. With the riders on gravel bikes. They bring their time trial bikes for the time trials and their gravel bikes for the gravel stages. Who knows? It might happen.
It will all hinge on the ability of television networks to create a product that is appealing to an audience, isn't it? And it's, practically poses considerable challenges, and particularly on a course like the one you described this week, Rich, in La Serenissima, because on those single track courses, sections of gravel, I don't know if it would even be possible, possibly with buggies, but again, there are costs involved in all of this. And, there are other issues as well, with, just dust and challenges you don't face if you're trying to televise a road race. So I think that's tricky, and that's been one of the key reasons why mountain biking it sort of reached a bit of a glass ceiling, didn't it, Lionel?
Well, it did, didn't it? I mean, I suppose the peak was in the late 90s, and then, I think they found it harder and harder to find places that wanted to pay the money to host the events. And the great irony now, of course, is that we've just had the Olympic Games with a mountain bike event where two of the a big star, Mathieu van der Poel, and an emerging star, Tom Pidcock, were the big talking points and stories from that particular race. So I think, I don't know, it's not, I think there's always a danger of thinking that one is going to replace the other. And I think, Richard, you're right. There's a place for it, and it will be a sort of crossover thing rather than a suddenly all, clamouring for a gravel world tour.
Mm. Well, let's hear, shall we, from Taco van der Hoorn, the Intermarché rider, who certainly took it seriously and flew in for the race. And here's what he thought of it at the end.
Yeah, it was okay. I enjoyed it. Yeah. So yeah, it was nice. And actually, was in the beginning was a lot of gravel and was quite difficult. And the last part was actually a lot of paved road and not really so much gravel. But it was still nice to do, and Lutsenko was too strong. But yeah, it was fun doing, but it was hard.
I guess you weren't able to recce any of it. You didn't kind of know where you were going or what you were going to experience.
I knew everything.
You did, yeah.
Yeah. I did.
Had you ridden it? Or?
Yeah, I did a recce on Wednesday already. Yeah, okay. I was here already, so I knew what was going on. But we did quite easy in the beginning because it was still long, and but in the end was fun to do, and it was something different.
Gravel racing is obviously an evolving thing. The course here looked quite different to other gravel races I've seen. Have you ridden other gravel races as well?
No, this was my first one, so that was also the reason I wanted to do it, because I was curious about it. But yeah, it's different because it's a lot of bike path, so it's for with people like peloton like today with 30 guys or 40 guys, then it's okay, but you cannot ride with 20 on the 20 guys here, because then it's only about positioning, and so then it's gonna be they have to go for bigger roads, and just if you have races like Port Epic or the other Strade Bianche or the other gravel road races, it's all wider roads, and you can do that for just only take that road for the whole course, then would be a nice gravel race, for my opinion. But today it was too. With a peloton like this was nice, but the course was too narrow.
And how was the bike? Because you had a special gravel bike today as well.
Yeah, it was nice. Yes, I was really really nice to ride on it, and I really did a bit too less pressure, I think, also in the tires, because it was nice for the first part with the corners and the gravel. But afterwards, it was really a lot of paved road, and I was expecting it to go a bit harder in the beginning, so I didn't put so much in it. But on the paved road, it was a bit too soft. But it's also the first race, so you have to learn about it a bit and think about it. But it's nice to have the gravel bike, and it's something different, and also for training or something, I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
It's developing very quickly, and the UCI are bringing in a world championship. Is it something you'd like to do more of?
Yeah, I would love to do it more. Yeah. If there is a possibility and it's possible to do it in my schedule for the road, then I would love to do some of the races. And I think for me it would be better if the race is a little bit longer. For example, if you have 200, more like the more endurance. But I would love to do it, yeah.
And nice to be back in Italy, scene of your greatest triumph this year, I think.
That's true, yeah. I love to be here. So I also went directly after Puri Tour to stay also at the last part of the season, also a bit enjoying Italy, a bit of the holiday, because now the weather is much nicer here to end the season and to do some training than at home in 10 degrees and rain. So also because of doing next week still Trenta, so it's nice to be here for 1 week also to keep the engine going and to train this environment and instead of Holland.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting our episode this week to remind us to tell you that it is sponsored by Calm. Calm is the number one mental wellness app, which has become part of my routine whenever I travel, which of course is what I've been doing this past week. And as lovely as it is to be in northern Italy in this beautiful autumn sunshine, I often struggle to sleep when I'm away from home. When I can't sleep, I listen now to Calm's sleep stories. I'm a particular fan of Eric Braz's tales of long train journeys. It's always great to see new ones added. I also listen sometimes to the soundscapes, usually of rain crashing against the window or waves crashing on the shore. I find these really effective at just slowing down my brain, helping me relax and ultimately to fall asleep. We're partnering with Calm, the number one mental wellness app, to give you the tools that improve the way you feel. Clear your head with guided daily meditations, improve your focus with Calm's music tracks, and drift off to dreamland with Calm's imaginative sleep stories. And if you go to calm.com/cycle, you'll get a limited time offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of programming, and new content is added every week. Over 100 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds. Go to calm.com/cycle for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/cycle. Well, we heard before the break there from Taco van der Hoorn, the Intermarché rider. He did actually ride the Veneto Classic as well, but his team were not too, well, they weren't as visible and active in that race as they had been actually in the gravel race. It was another disappointing race, the Veneto Classic, for UAE Team Emirates, because last week in the Giro del Veneto, Mark Hirschi had been away when he crashed in the Veneto Classic on Sunday. It was Matteo Trentin who was away with Samuele Battistella, who would hold on to win the race, but it was a very strange incident where Trentin crashed. It was on the climb, he got out of the saddle, and I'm not sure if he touched the wheel of Battistella or not. It was kind of hard to tell, but he went down pretty hard, and then he had a mechanical problem with his bike as well later on, and he finished the race pretty angry. It was a great win by Battistella, wasn't it, and completed a really good week for Astana, but UAE Team Emirates, pretty raw, I think. Hirschi did manage to finish on the podium. He was second. Jonathan Restrepo of Androni Giocattoli was third, Colombian rider who used to be at Katusha and was considered a great prospect, so that was a good result and performance by him. But yeah, UAE Team Emirates left empty-handed at the end of this week of racing.
Well, it's funny, Rich. They were clearly the strongest team in terms of personnel in the Veneto races, the Veneto Classic and the Giro del Veneto. And the night before the Veneto Classics on Saturday night, I know Ciro was exchanging messages with Beppe Martinelli, the Astana director sportif. And Martinelli had said to Ciro that, well, UAE were too strong, so he was going to have to come up with something, a bit of a ruse, some sort of master plan to defeat them. And that was going to be basically luring them into thinking that Astana were riding for Lutsenko. And he said to Ciro, I'm going to unleash Battistella tomorrow. And
well, he did.
Yes, and wow, incredible, incredible clairvoyance.
A promising young rider. He's the world under 23 champion, wasn't he, in Harrogate?
Controversially.
A couple of years ago.
Controversially, yeah. When Niels Ekhoff was disqualified.
Indeed. Another team, another World Tour team that were in action there were Cofidis. And somebody who came in just for the Veneto Classic was Guillaume Martin, after his starring role in the Tour de France presentation midweek. He looked particularly dashing in his suit, his open neck shirt, coat and scarf slung over his arm. He looked very bookish in his glass little spectacles, but he wanted to carry on racing and came out here to ride this final race of the year. And he was very active. He was finished eighth in the end. Daniel, you pointed out that he gave an interview last week where he said that he had not abandoned a race since February 2018.
Yeah, well, this has been noted by a few people recently, and he was asked about it. But the list, Rich, before we hear from him, it's extraordinary. So this league table of riders who were the longest period since their last DNF, and he is in front by over 100 race days. So Guillaume Martin, 310 race days since his last DNF. The next rider is Esteban Chavez, who's at 209. We had a conversation about this at the start of the year, didn't we? We talked about some kind of 100 club, creating or founding some kind of 100 club, 100 plus race days with no DNFs, and there are there are 17 of them. So Pro Cycling Stats has down men and women. Sepp Kuss is on there, Amy Peters, Peo Bilbao.
Well, Marta is in the, what colour of jersey would you wear for that? For never DNFing. I mean, what is there a colour that would be appropriate? I'm not sure that there is.
Pretty one torn and ripped and decaying.
Yeah, you've got to wear the same jersey for every single day you don't DNF. So
brilliant. Well, here's what he obviously enjoyed his day out at Veneto, so here's what he said at the finish.
That was an entertaining race to watch. What was it like to ride?
Not so funny, to be honest. That was a really long race to finish the season, and a really hard one also, with that final laps were really always up and down. I did with what I had left in the legs after the whole season. It was a really tough season, so I'm happy to be there again in the mix for the last one. And now I can go on holidays happy.
But you're here by choice, I guess. You wanted to ride this race. Why did you want to race so late in the year?
I think I'm a bit an addict of racing. So, and also there is a race for points, I think. Everybody doesn't know it, but for the teams it's really important to not only to win races but also to finish, I don't know, 5 and 6 to get some points, and that's why also we have to race till the end of the season and from the beginning of the season also. Also it's a nice way to conclude the season, nice weather, nice landscapes. And I'm really happy to discover this race.
You had to finish because you gave an interview this week where you said you've finished every race you've done since February 2018. I think about 300 race days in a row. Is that something that you've committed to consciously, that's important to you?
No, my goal is not to abandon. It's to do the best results possible. And I start every race really with a fighting spirit, and I think that's why I never give up. So I think that's the main explanation. And the last time, I think it was in Italy in the Gran Premio Liguria in early February 2018, and now I'm still in Italy more than three years later, and no abundance. So I'm also proud of it because it tells something about the kind of rider I am.
It must be strange to go to the tour presentation for next year and then race again, but what did you make of the tour route for next year?
It was a strange week for me because on Monday I was in Italy for Agostoni, and then I went back to France to see the presentation. I like the route, to be honest, not particularly the first stages that are really tricky and windy and flat, but starting from the fifth or sixth stage, it's always almost a mountain, so this part I like here. Yeah.
And what did you finally think about today in terms of what kind of race was it? Does it remind you of any other race or something completely different? You had the cobbled climb in there as well.
Yeah, I think it's a mix of every kind of race with a style of Flemish Classic, and then flat at the beginning, super hilly at the end, so punchy with the last climb. So yeah, you really have to be good in every part of cycling, also downhills, to be good on that race. And I think at the end, on the first group, you only had strong guys.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for fueling my ride. I'm around an hour and a quarter from home at the moment, and I've just stopped to have a little energy break, and I am going to have one of the Science in Sport Go Isotonic Energy Gels. Now, these are an absolute staple of the energy foods. I always put one of these in my pocket when I'm going for a ride, even if I'm only going for an hour. I'll have one halfway round just because it's going to keep those feelings of hunger at bay. And if I'm going hard, I'll have one every half an hour or so. They've got 22 grams of carbohydrate in each gel, and they're not overly calorific. They're 87 calories per 60 milliliter gel sachet. But that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is the flavour. So this is pink grapefruit I've gone for today. So let's have a taste. Well, that is light, it's fruity, it's citrusy, it's sweet, but not at all sickly. It's a burst of Florida sunshine. It's a non-alcoholic cocktail on a roof terrace. It's very easy to eat and it's packed with all the energy you need to fuel your ride. So I'm going to fold up the used wrapper and pop it in one of my jersey pockets and take it home with me. And I'm going to get on with my ride. And if you would like 25% off all Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com, you know the code by now. It's SISCP25.
Well, thanks very much to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And that was the first of your taste tests, Lionel.
Indeed it was. More of those to come over the coming weeks.
Excellent, excellent. A reminder, if you want 25% off your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. I wolfed down a couple of blueberry energy bars on Saturday. Science and Sport energy bars, of course. I'm always on brand. While doing the Gran Fondo, the Veneto Go, as it was called.
Was this before or after you dropped Fabian Cancellara?
Well, it was during the Gran Fondo that I dropped him, Lionel.
Yeah, did you take the gels?
Hope he's not listening.
Take the gels and then drop him?
It's fair to say that Cancellara was starting to struggle a little bit on the climb of La Resina. It is a tough climb. It's got hairpins. It's like a mini Alpe d'Huez, really, very mini. But it was a very enjoyable ride. I've never ridden a.
Given that Cancellara has put his name to a series of events, I don't exactly know the format, but they are called Chasing Cancellara.
Well, he had Chasing Cancellara.
Will we now get the Chasing Buffalo Moor series?
I was only chasing him for so long up that climb, I can tell you.
Stopped at the side of the road to put on your dropping Cancellara socks. Did you?
I wouldn't want to overplay this, but it was my first Gran Fondo experience. I would obviously, but it was my first Gran Fondo experience, and it was unlike any other sportif I've done. You mentioned, Daniel, that this is quite common, I think, but it was basically a race. I mean, Pozzato said he didn't want it to be a race. He wanted it to be fun and not about finishing in the fastest time. There was a refreshment stop around 70 kilometres in. It was 112 kilometres in total. And it was a race from the start. You know, it was not, there was no kind of, you know, no riding two abreast. It was very much a peloton, and it was a lot of fun to be in. It was fast, but not too fast. Cancellara and Ivan Basso were leading my group, and lots of very fit riders, lots of very expensive bikes around me. But I had a lot of fun, and we'll hear more about that in the episode of Explore. Something I did do as we climbed La Resina was I recorded the climb for Slow Radio, and so let's hear a bit of that now, shall we? Me climbing La Resina. You can hear is Fabian Cancellara, because he talked pretty much all the way up, which is maybe partly why he ran out of puff towards the end. But let's hear a bit from La Resina. Well, I hope that transported you there, chaps. Did it? Into my back pocket, as we claim La Resina. There was a bit of material sound there. We have had a couple of submissions for Slow Radio recently. Keep them coming. We will be resurrecting that over the winter. A couple of good ones have come in, though, so I'm looking forward to featuring those. On Sunday at the... Sorry, Daniel.
Who's the most famous person you've dropped, Lionel?
Oh, this is a setup. I don't think I even dropped Laura and Emma Trott when they were racing in a third cat race at Hillingdon. I think they were ahead of me.
Laura Trott was 9 at the time.
She was a bit older than that. She wouldn't have been allowed to race in a third cat race until, you know, got to a junior age. So,
Daniel, have you dropped anyone famous? Yeah.
Funny you should mention that, Rich, because, there was one illustrious victim, Frank Vandenbroucke, the late Frank Vandenbroucke in 2001. It was about my second assignment for Pro Cycling Magazine. I was dispatched to their training camp in Tuscany, Castagneto Carducci, and they invited me to ride with the team. Got fully kitted out in Lamprey gear, and we went out in Gilberto Simoni. Who else was there? I think Max Chantry might have been riding for them that year. Anyway, off we went, and Vandenbroucke was coming off two very difficult years. I think this was the start of his problems, you know, possibly even his addiction problems that later very sadly led to his demise. But he was at the training camp, but not in a very good place, I don't think. And at one point, he decided that I think that he was going to go back to the hotel. He wasn't going to finish the training ride. And we had I had a very enthusiastic, very charming, but slightly overzealous photographer, Nigel Farrow, his name was on that trip. And I think it was his first trip to a cycling team training camp. And anyway, Nigel pulled alongside the whole pace line in the car and shouted out the window, "Daniel, you've dropped Vandenbroucke. Keep going. You've dropped him." Thinking that this was quite a serious accomplishment.
Well, he must have been like a bag of washing at the time.
There you go.
Not far off his pomp as well, but well done, Daniel. I have to say there was a disappointing lack of retro Italian jerseys on display. No Lamprey, no Mappe, no Androni jerseys on display in the Gran Fondo. They're all wearing the latest, the latest clothing. Non-team issue.
That is disappointing.
But speaking of Androni, I did speak to Gianni Savio, whose rider, Jonathan Restrepo, was third in the Veneto Classic. He's got a new sponsor for next year, so his team carries on. It was an important result for them as well, this. So here's Gianni Savio from the finish of the Veneto Classic.
My English is very bad.
It's very good. You always say that, but it's very good. A good ride today by Jonathan. He seems to have done well on your team.
Yes. Today he made a very good race because he was with the first. He attacked and after he had the energy to make the sprint and he was the third podium for us is very good. And with these results we are also podium in the Italian Championship for team. Because he is the first UAE, second, and I think third Trek, I think.
So that's very important.
Yes, for us is very important. It's a very good result.
And what did you?
I am happy.
You're happy. What did you think of this race?
Very good. I made the compliments to Filippo Pozzato because a very good race. And a very well organization, because I think that this is very important. A new race in Italy, but a new big race. So many compliments to Pippo Pozzato and to his organizer.
And you have a new sponsor for next year. Are your plans all in place for next year?
Yes, yes. We have a new sponsor, but also Androni will continue with us. The new name will be Drone Hopper Androni Giocattoli.
And when will we see your kit? When will we see your jersey for next year?
We are starting studied this. We have studied this. I think that in 2 weeks we will have.
Because people love your jersey with all the names on, but you have lots of names again next year.
Less. So with the sponsor most important, but always we must have. A few of sponsors, because we have no the big sponsorship, and for this reason we have from
lots of smaller sponsors.
Yes,
yeah. It's good to hear from Gianni Rich. As
he said to say hi, Daniel.
Did he? Yeah. I'll give him a call this week. They have finished on the podium again of the Coppa Italia. Less important this year because we know in the past they have obtained a Giro wild card by virtue of winning the Coppa Italia. I don't think they'll have too many problems getting into the Giro next year because, well, it's been widely reported, I think, over the last few days that Vini Zabu, the Italian Pro Conti team, are in trouble and are likely to shut down. I've spoken to people on the team this morning and they've confirmed that it's 99% certain that team will close, which is pretty sad. Well, you'll remember probably that in the spring, one of their riders, Matteo De Bonis, tested positive, and this led to raids on a number of individuals' homes, including Luca Cinto and Angelo Citracca, the sort of head honchos of that team. And yeah, it's going to close. It's been a team it's been around for a number of years in different iterations, but it's, well, against the backdrop, we said we talked about Italian cycling and the Italian cycling industry sort of rediscovering some of its old mojo, or possibly doing that over the next few years. The professional scene is still quite troubled, and I don't think any of the riders, or one of the riders, I think, Vini Zabu, Simone Bevilacqua, has got a contract for next year, but otherwise they are all unemployed. And I think, chaps, over the next few weeks, just looking at some World Tour rosters, there are quite a lot of teams that haven't finalised their rosters, and we will be in the very familiar position over the next few weeks of talking about guys who are contemplating probably the premature end of their career, because there are quite a lot who don't have arrangements for next year. It's funny on that, chaps. I was talking to some agents at the Worlds a couple of weeks ago, Rich, and talking about the sort of movements in the market this year and some of the wider phenomena. And one thing that's come up a few times in the last few months has been teams being afraid of the kind of opportunity cost of keeping these sort of mid-age, so between 27 to 32 year old maybe, stalwarts who don't necessarily get great results, but they've been sort of solid servants to teams for a long time. And a lot of teams, I think, have had their heads turned over the last 3 or 4 years by, well, a couple of things. The emergence of these super talents, these very young super talents who, you can sign up on their first pro deal for not very much money, and they might just, it is like buying a lottery ticket. You might just hit the jackpot. And then, there are other sort of talent pools that are being exploited, and like South America, for example. I think the Colombians haven't had quite such a good season this year, but there as well, there are a lot of guys who appear to or could possibly have the potential to thrive in Europe, and they're not necessarily the most expensive riders, particularly when it is their first experience of Pro Tour racing or Pro Conti racing. And often it's the, as I say, those solid sort of stalwart workhorses that are being forced out. I mean, I think of a team like EF Education First, who have announced a couple of signings in the last few days, or in the last couple of weeks. They've had a busy period in the market. And you've got guys like Will Barter, the American, Lawson Craddock, neither of whom at the moment certainly have had their contracts renewed. And I don't think that they have signed anywhere at the moment. But I see it as being a difficult sort of winter for some riders of that ilk.
And yet those guys are needed. I mean, Lawson Craddock, what a brilliant job he did for Magnus Cort at the Vuelta. Maybe went a long way to helping him win that stage when those two were away in a break. I mean, and I think automatically somehow of somebody like Salvatore Puccio, who within that team at Ineos Grenadiers would describe him often as the most valuable member of the team. I spoke to an agent as well a few weeks ago who said that in particular riders in their young mid-20s are struggling to get a second contract because teams are looking at ever younger riders. And they're obviously looking for stars, but they also need the workhorses, don't they? They need the guys like the Puccios and the Craddocks who can do a great job for the team when required.
But I think some of it undeniably is also due to the accessibility of information, firstly, and also live coverage or highlights of races. There are so many races now that team managers can watch, and they can have their heads turned. They can think they've spotted the next, I don't know, whatever, Tadej Pogacar. And whereas previously, scouting and information gathering, intel gathering, as far as recruitment was concerned, was conducted much more on a word of mouth basis. And you did sort of double down on those guys who you knew, had 3 or 4 or 5 years experience of just doing a job. Okay, they weren't spectacular, but you didn't necessarily want to take the risk of signing someone you'd never seen in a race before, or you're only going on the basis of a few results in under 23 races. Now, team managers have all the physiological data, they have the results, they can very easily access those, but more importantly as well, they can watch them in action.
Well, listen, chaps, I should go and enjoy my last couple of hours of beautiful autumn sunshine here in Bassano del Grappa. Daniel, when we were here, we stayed in the B&B Hemingway, didn't we, next door to the Hemingway Museum. Sadly, it's closed today. I'm glad that I did manage to visit it early that Sunday morning, because it's closed on a Monday. It's well worth a visit if anybody is in the area. F. Scott Fitzgerald also lived here briefly during World War One. I rode to Asilo yesterday, where Robert Browning, the English poet, once lived. And in fact, the house in which he lived was bought a few years ago by the family. Is it Massimo Zanetti, the Segafredo boss? So there's a cycling link there. It's now a hotel in Asilo, and it's the old Robert Browning house, now owned by the Zanetti family.
Also, Rich, famous for an association with another Asilo, with another...
Bacala.
No, with another writer, English writer, Freya Stark. You heard of her? Quite a famous travel writer. Mm. But I think spent most of her life in Asilo, if I remember correctly.
Well, Mr. Bacala, the man who puts a lot of money into De Koenig Quickstep, also has a house there. Filippo Pozzato told me. It feels like a wealthy place. Bassano del Grappa as well feels like quite a wealthy place. Is that a correct impression?
The whole region, it's had its difficulties in the last few years because of, its wealth was built on manufacturing after the Second World War, and it's sort of ceded a lot of wealth to the Far East over the last 20, 30 years. But, slightly resurgent, I would say.
Oh, it's lovely. I'll take a stroll down the Brenta River and enjoy, as I say, the last couple of hours of lovely sunshine here. It's beautiful. Recommend a visit to this part of the world in autumn if you get a chance.
Just before we go, Rich, you may remember we ran a competition to win a set of Jaybird Vista Sport earphones, and it was a rollover, wasn't it? Because nobody predicted the winner of the World Championship, so we rolled it over to Men's Paris-Roubaix, and we have a winner, Kay Naldrit. Congratulations, you predicted that Sonny Colbrelli would win Paris-Roubaix, and your earphones are on their way to you. Hopefully you've received them by now, but congratulations.
I saw a new pair of shoes being made for Sonny Colbrelli in the CD factory the other day. Sewing machine operator, hand-making these shoes. It was absolutely fascinating to watch. So, Sonny Colbrelli, if you're listening, your new shoes should be ready pretty soon. That's all for this week, I think. We'll be back next week. I think we've got an episode of Service Course coming out later this week as well. We've got some episodes of Explore to come too.
And the final episode of Life in the Peloton for this season, Mitch Docker contemplating retirement. That will be out on Wednesday.
Our latest friend special was my episode from Flanders. Got a message the other day from somebody who had, having heard it, gone on their own little tour of Flanders and stayed in the Flandrian Hotel. So that was nice to hear. And there are more friends specials coming very soon as well. You can sign up as a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com. But until next week, that's all from us. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
To become a friend of the podcast or to sign up for our weekly newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Our theme music is by Glass Pear, and this episode was produced by Hugh Owen.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.